Welcome to Shattering Myths, a program devoted to the most important, fastest growing, and now largest segment of society. To those who know that the world's political, religious, military, economic, academic, and media institutions are corrupt, that they are counterproductive, and that they cannot be fixed. Our mission, therefore, is to expose them so that more people come to understand this reality and ultimately disjoin their lives from these institutions. Our phone number, if you'd like to participate in this discussion, it is 877-300-7645. I mentioned this in passing yesterday, but have not commented much on it. I am going to share what little I can distill based upon the two nights of riots in Ferguson, Missouri, which is just north of St. Louis. The county police chief, John Belmar, said that the shooting occurred after an officer encountered two people, one of whom is now the deceased young man, Brown, who had just graduated from high school and was on his way to college. And they confronted them on a street near an apartment complex in Ferguson. Now, before I read more, I have seen a lot of videos recently of police acting like they're Gestapo and telling people who are just minding their own business, walking down the street, you know, just going from one place to another, going for a walk, to stop and to show them their ID. And there's a lot of people that don't like police, don't like the institution, don't like their attitude, and bristle at that and say, you know, no, mind your own business, you know, go bother somebody else. And they'll have people, you know, put their hands up or lay down, tell them to lay down on the ground, spread eagle. Why should a cop be able to tell you to do that? So you have to lay spread eagle on the ground, and they're going to put their foot on your back and handcuff you just because they don't like the way you're walking or the way you look.
Technically, they can't. They can't do that.
They are, and they say that they have the legal jurisdiction. There was a wonderful video. It's a hideous video, but it shows this whole mindset. There's an African-American woman. She's kind of heavy set, but beautifully attired, extremely articulate. She is a professor at University of Arizona. This is in Tucson. And a cop says, I want to see your stop. I want to see your ID. And she says, no, I'm just walking down the sidewalk, you know, minding my own business. You have no right to do that. So, oh, yes, I do. I said, stop and show me your ID. She says, no, I'm not going to be harassed in that way. Go away. I'm just minding my own business. I'm a professor here at the university. He says, you don't understand the law. I told you to stop and pull out your ID. And she did the same thing I did. She said, no, go bother somebody else. Well, the cop manhandled her, literally, and wrestled her to the ground. It was disgusting. Well, this is set up the same way. White cops, black boys walking down the street instead of the black woman walking down the street. By the way, another example of this just appeared earlier this week. There's a video by a passing by motorist of a white California Highway Patrol motorcycle operator. Pulls a African-American woman, unarmed, not drugged, just unarmed, African-American woman out of the car, and gets her on the ground and starts pounding her. I mean, fist flying left and right, just pounding. So this is happening a lot now. And it's a serious problem in America. Anyway, no one knows what transpired here. So I'm just telling you, giving you some stuff that I do know that may be applicable, may not be. Anyway, they encountered the two men outside of the apartment complex in Ferguson. Belmar, this county police chief, said that one of the men pushed the officer back into his squad car. And then a struggle began. So, if this is similar to what I've seen, where the person said, you know, you've got no right to harass me this way. Just go away. And the officer gets to be aggressive, and people push back. My guess is that's what happened. But, you know, again, I'm not there. But you know, our job in reviewing the news is to come to the is to present the most likely situation, the best explanation for the outcome based upon what we know. And based on what we know, that's the most likely outcome. That these kids didn't want to be harassed by the police. They were doing nothing wrong. And that the police were still being belligerent towards them. Anyway, well, they claim that one of the two boys, not the one necessarily that is now dead, Brown, but pushed the officer back into his police car. And then a struggle began. Velmar said that at least one shot was fired from the officer's gun inside the police car. Now, that's pretty amazing in itself. So, one of the two boys pushes, let's say that actually occurred this way, had a reason to want to push the one of the officers away from him. The officer ends up in his car. And the officer then chooses to immediately pull his revolver, and fire at the kid. Now, you hear all of this excuse that the kid was going for the officer's gun. Well, it's really hard to go for somebody's gun if that gun is in the hand of the officer and he's pulling the trigger, firing at you.
Well, witnesses said that one of the witnesses of the case told local media that Brown had his hands raised in the air, arms up in the air,
yeah,
when he was shot.
Yeah.
So if my hand, obviously, if you pull a gun, I mean, hey, all
right,
right. Hey, I'm backing away. And why was Brown in the car to begin with?
I don't think Brown was in the car. I mean, I know that there's a lot of speculation. This, according to the sheriff, Velmar, who is now reporting on what he has been told by his officers, Brown wasn't in the car. That was one of the things that, you know, Brown was in the car and then he struggled to get the officer's gun. According to the sheriff, the police chief for this area, the county police chief, not sheriff, it was the officer who was in the car. And Brown was out of the car, and the officer fired the first shot from the car. And then the police chief says the remaining shots, of which there were seven, were discharged from that same officer's gun into Brown, who was unarmed. And as you've heard the witnesses say, whose hands are up in the air, it is interesting to note that throughout yesterday, the primary protests, although there was some looting and some rioting, for the most part, the local community protested by going up to the police who were, you know, like in riot SWAT formations, heavily armed, and going up to about 10 feet of them and raising their hands above their heads, down on their knees with their hands up in their heads, above their heads, signifying what Brown was doing prior to him receiving seven or eight rounds into his body. And the comments, you know what the most common comment was that was recorded by the demonstrators doing that? What the police said?
No, I don't.
They're animals.
That makes me mad.
It makes me mad. It's the same mentality that has now been enjoined into the military. You know, back in World War II, what the military found is that most humans are not keen on killing other humans, and that they'll do so if there's cognitive dissonance of some sort. You know, the flight crews of a bomber know that when we drop white phosphorus bombs on a city, women and children are being burned alive in a hideous way, but they can't see their victims.
They don't.
But if you're if you're sitting there with a gun and you have in your sights an enemy combatant, and you know if you pull the trigger, you're going to blow off his head. Most Americans couldn't do it. And very few did it. And so after World War II, to train and doctrinate military for Vietnam and subsequent wars, West Point initiated a plan where foes would be dehumanized. They were no longer civilians, they were now terrorists. You know, they had no reason to die. They had reason to live. They were inferior. It goes back to the old indoctrination of the Romans, where they as savages told one another that those outside were barbarians. Well, the fact is that it's the same thing that happened in the conquest of America. The native peoples were called savages while they were savaged by the European colonists. That's what happened. And that mentality is now in our police departments. And it ought to make you mad.
Well, Dorian Johnson is the other gentleman that was with Brown. And he told a television station, KMOV, that he and Brown were walking, and when the officer confronted him, drew a weapon and shot. Johnson said that Brown put his hands in the air and started to get down, but the officer kept shooting. So if that statement is at all true, this cop is a murderer.
Absolutely.
A cold-blooded murderer.
Yes. That is correct. And I'm telling you that, well, I don't know who's telling the truth here. But if the cops, if the police chief's version is correct, then the officer who shot Brown that many times is at best guilty of reckless endangerment homicide, the same crime that Tony Stewart, I think, is guilty of committing. He didn't have the intent to kill initially, although the subsequent shots would have been intent to kill.
I think this is different. That he might, you don't shoot unless, I'm sorry, they tell you if you're going to shoot at somebody, you shoot if you're shooting to warn, you're shooting in the air or something.
No, he wasn't shooting to warn. He was shooting.
He was shooting to kill.
And by the way, cops don't shoot to warn. Cops shoot to
kill.
You're
told to take out your gun and kill that other person.
Right.
And so, therefore, if you're shooting that many times,
deadly force is warranted if there is imminent risk of your life. The person he shot did not have a weapon, so there could not have been imminent threat to his life. So I'm going to go along with you in this analysis. I did see, by the way, another four or five times the tape of Tony Stewart, and I, before we move to the rest of the news this morning, and to a briefing that I received early this morning, I want to speak of that situation once again. Before we add one more comment to the Tony Stewart incident of yesterday, which dominated, by the way, radio sports news, and I was extraordinarily disappointed in the quality of analysis provided by talk radio show hosts and the callers into those programs. So we're going to take one more swipe at that. But before we do, we have Glenn on the line, and I think Glenn has a comment on what is happening in Missouri. Hello, Glenn.
Yes, good morning. Welcome to Watts 2014.
Yes, indeed. Except for the fact that I've got to tell you that from what I have seen, although there was a convenience store looted, and although there were some cars, windows, and that sort of thing that were broken into, from what I've seen, the protests here against the police department have been more symbolic than they have been violent. And, of course, in Watts, I mean, they torched the city. They looted every store.
Right.
It was so. I think it's a little bit. I'm not an expert on all that's happened, but what I have seen thus far, it looks like most of those who are protesting are doing so in an extraordinarily effective symbolic way, which is to get down on their knees and to raise their hands before the cops that are spewing venom at them.
Well, I had heard presentation from someone who's from that area and has police contacts and that sort of thing, and said that there were some house fires and some lootings and burnings. My mind is reeling with all sorts of thoughts and input on, you know, on this. First of all, obviously, it's horrific.
Yeah, by the way, I am sensitive. I am really sensitive to the Los Angeles riots because there were two of them. And I grew up in the Los Angeles area through both of them. And it was the second one that caused me to leave the Los Angeles area. And when I saw how readily the community in Watts got out of control and became hoodlums with them robbing and stealing. It is interesting, too, that the looting ended on the day. That was back in the time where your welfare check was sent in the mail. And the looting ended the day that their welfare checks arrived. And it was a statement that was so loud and clear for those whose ears and eyes were open.
Well, we live in a day when cities, you know, downtowns are looted and ravaged when their sports teams win a championship.
Right.
So that tells you there's always this opportunistic, parasitic element within the culture that will use the diversion as an excuse to be evil and steal.
And there's also gang mentality. You can never underestimate the nature of a gang as to how people's individual judgment, already impaired, is obliterated in gang activity.
Right. And again, the word counterproductive, and boy, there's nothing more counterproductive than the looting aspect and smashing, destruction involved in riots.
Yeah, those are vendors that are actually taking the risk of being robbed and of being murdered and of establishing a presence in a community that's prone to violence to serve that community. And when those are being robbed and looted, that's the reason why after the second Watts riots, the Koreans who were willing to keep those stores open, just they armed themselves and became so concerned about the behavior of African Americans towards them because of what happened in those riots. That's the reason why when the Donald Sterling thing came up and there was a Koreatown apartment building managed by Koreans, and Donald Sterling is the one that's blamed for anti-Semitic behavior, and I said, no. There's a whole history here, folks.
Right. And so first of all, if we slice them out of the equation, the opportunists and the randomly violent, and look at the people who are approaching this, you know, conscientiously, with scruples, and this is a fantastic opportunity. The misbehavior of police all over the country, this is a great opportunity, and President Obama is the perfect president to address this because of his racial background. He is endeared to his white grandmother, and so now is the time for people to stand up. But give meaning to the death of this young man and say, listen, police, listen, governors, listen, mayors, listen, President Obama. Stop the belligerence of the police officers. You all know. You know in these police departments, all at wing, and when they're in a locker room or they, you know, are about their business, and they all know who the Roid Rangers are among them, who the psychos, who the belligerents are. Clean house. Okay, set your house in order, or you are going to precipitate.
How can you set your house in your order from a national level, Glenn, when the President of the United States has killed 5,000 civilians with drones? When the President of the United States decides that the way to solve a problem that we created by bombing is to bomb some more. You know,
well, the cry must go out. It's hypocritical, yes. But the cry, nonetheless, should go up.
Oh, I'm with you. This is not, from what I can tell, this is not a Trayvon Martin issue. We'll be back in a moment. Welcome back to Shattering Mystery. I'm in a conversation with Glenn and with Scott. And, I ended the last segment by saying this is not a Trayvon Martin incident, to the best of my knowledge. I don't know Brown. I mean, I know what his mother has said about him, that he was a good kid, that he was a high school student going off now to college, that he was unarmed. And he was killed by a police officer whose gun was given to him, who was paid by the community, by the nation. Trayvon Martin was not a good kid. Trayvon Martin didn't deserve to die, but he certainly did everything he could have done to put himself in harm's way with his attitude. And the man who killed him was not a officer of the public. And so this is a very, very different situation. And so, Glenn, I am just saying that to say I agree with you. Our police are acting like the military. And if you were one of those who listened in to the video and audio of the American gunship in Iraq killing a half a dozen Iraqi civilians, including a young boy and a child, and giggling why they're doing it.
Right.
And you know the attitude now of the military. That attitude is permeating our police departments, and it's a serious problem in America. I don't look at this as a racial problem. I think this is a belligerence problem, and it goes right back to the indoctrination that began at West Point to dehumanize the enemy, which is why the comment that the police are making at those who are putting up their hands in symbolic gestures for on behalf of Brown, why them calling them animals is so indicative of what's wrong.
Right. Now, well, now is a good time to push back and say, look, we are not the enemy. We are those who employ you. We are, you know, this is the government of the people. We are the people. We are not animals. We are not the enemy. We're technically your bosses, you know, and in the long run.
Yeah, but Glenn, let me ask you this question. If the government did not view you and I and all of those who are not part of the government as the enemy, why would they have invested hundreds of millions of dollars through the NSA to spy on us?
Well, no, I agree that they do, but they, you know, this is we people can push back or not. You can either submit or stand.
Right.
And you know, now is a good time to start making some noise. Those soldiers, obviously, there's always been a divide sort of between foreign policy and domestic policy. So, yes, but those soldiers who you know, you're talking about with that the shooting from the helicopter, probably saw the movie Full Metal Jacket. Mm-hmm. And, like, one of the most, you know, memorable scenes in Full Metal Jacket is where the journalist is on a helicopter and the gunner's shooting people in a rice paddy, and he's saying, how can you shoot women and children like that? And he says, it's easy. You just don't lead them so much. You know, it's about the practice of shooting them, not about the ethics of shooting them. But fortunately, there's always been this huge distinction between the military and the domestic police. And we've seen the militarization of police. We've seen fusion centers. Right. We've seen this integration of
the SWAT teams. They're using military hardware. And now with an alphabet soup of federal officers from the FBI to Department of Homeland Security to the Department of Alcohol, Firearms, and Tobacco, and on, there is a national federal police that is almost indistinguishable now from local police, and the integration of the two is an extraordinarily enormous threat. I mean, I can't overemphasize this, to America, to liberty, to freedom, to life as we know it.
But they've been giving us this in predictive programming in the movies for decades. They gave us, in the movie, the comedic movie with Dan Aykroyd, Dragnet, we see the LAPD has its own tank and its own, you know, a fighter plane. We see in Die Hard, we see an armed personnel carrier take soldiers up to the front of a building. They've been conditioning us to accept this, and it's time to reject it. But no. The police charge is supposed to say to protect and to serve for a reason.
Yeah.
There's a pretty easy way to cut back on these incidents, though. You make them wear the cameras. You make them wear those cameras
proposed,
That should be. They're a government. They're a government employee.
Right.
No, you replace them with robots.
Well, no, you just
I
put that camera.
You know why? You know why that camera wasn't on those cars? Because they didn't want the evidence.
Well, that's
because the cameras are more likely to be used as evidence against the officer than they are on behalf of the officer.
And they're there, but they're there for our protection.
The tapes are lost. The tapes are continually lost. That's why the data from the cameras should go immediately into secure internet servers and be secured by objective third parties.
I don't see it that way, Scott. Is they're there for our protection? That's the myth. It's kind of like the myth of the U.S. military is providing a service to us and keeping America free and your freedom is owed to the American military. That is a complete lie. Idea of protect and serve is a myth now being promoted by police departments. They have become belligerent, and they are now serving their own interests. They, you know, I when I first released Prophet of Doom, and I was getting hundreds of death threats a month, some of the death threats became very personal. Know where you live. Know your daily routine. And we're going to kill you. And we're going to take out your family as well. And so when the death threats became very specific, with somebody having knowledge of where I was, I called the FBI, and I sent them to the FBI. That's their job, right? I mean, you can't make a threat like that without that being a crime. You know what the FBI said? Go away. It's your problem.
Yeah, and I'm not telling you, I'm not saying that I looked at them to protect me.
I was mugged three times when I went as a student at USC. I was mugged three times. One time I was mugged was right across, at gunpoint, right across from the police station. When I had the police out with three witnesses with me, big guys, you know, all-American athletes with me at the time. And we told the police we wanted to give a report because we were robbed at gunpoint. I mean, that's a felony. The police came out and says, we're not going to take a report. There's nothing we can do about it. Not going to even bother to take a report. So this myth that the police are there to protect you and to serve you, it's just not true anymore.
Well, I'll be the first one to tell you that I don't look to them to do anything for me. Every time they're around, I want nothing more than get away from that.
Mm-hmm. Me too. I have an aversion to them.
But that's just it, is that they're not there to hurt. Their job is not to harass people.
Right.
And force
and they
people.
Are now harassing people.
Exactly. So put the cameras on them. If you had a camera and it's going to some place like Glenn
said,
I'm
going to tell you though.
To a,
let me give you a great
central.
Example though, Scott. That a camera was on the situation. You can Google it. The University of Arizona professor in Tucson that was harassed by the cop. The whole thing was recorded by the onboard camera, and the police chief reviewed the tape, pressed charges against the woman for harassing the police officer. And exonerated the police officer. So, there we are. You know, we had a camera on that the woman that was driving her three kids through, I think it was New Mexico, on a educational trip. And the police officer pulled her over. The police officer was so obnoxious. The woman was afraid for her the lives of her children. And she drove off, and the police officer, after confronting the eldest son and engaging him in a fight, then shot rounds into the car with the three children aboard as they were fleeing. Shot rounds into the car. And it's all recorded. And the local community exonerated the cop and prosecuted the woman and her son. So we have video. Our problem is national and it's attitudinal.
I'm saying that in this situation, if you had a video, there would be clear. It's like
yeah.
The Tony Stewart. You have the evidence there to look at and see how things are playing out.
Right.
And then you can make a, you know.
Yeah. I'm with you. I think the video is a nice, is a real positive addition and should be required. But I'm telling you, the nation has changed its attitude.
Right. Yeah. But the organizations as the governmental
right.
entities
right.
certainly have.
Correct.
But the people, now, I find the race element in this very disturbing because there are always powers that be that who want to, you know, trump up race tension, which is a bad idea. Because if that gets going, there's another element, and that is the Hispanic element. Blacks want to look for racism. The Mexicans, the Hispanics certainly dislike the blacks. So it wants, and when that third element gets brought in, it's going to be a nightmare. And
yes.
And like in among the Mexican gangs, to
right.
be a full fledged member, you often have to kill a black person. So you know this is crazy. So I would prefer to see everybody stand up against the corruption in among the government entities and say, yes, you know, we know you don't think you're here to protect the service. We're reminding you that is why we pay you to do this. And it's time for, and when you have corrupt police chiefs and corrupt, then maybe you have to get mayors and governors involved.
Yeah, so there's two things we can think about here. One is that that there's a million between federal officers and county, state, and local police and sheriff. There's a million of them, all licensed to carry a weapon in America. Way, way, way overkill. I mean, you could cut that number by two-thirds, and we'd all be safer from them. The second issue is that they don't all need to be armed. I'm sorry. They just don't all need to be armed. And, you know, if you look at the U.K., police officers of the U.K. aren't armed.
They are not.
Not all of them. Some of them are, but not all of them. And, again, the U.K. is taking the same attitude that America is taking, and it's going to backfire. It's going to be worse. You know, a cop would not be as aggressive if they were unarmed. And of course, the other side of the equation is that we have so trampled on our Constitution that most civilians are not armed. And that would change the equation as well. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. I said I wanted to talk briefly about the Tony Stewart incident. I watched the video several more times. And I have to say that I am a casual NASCAR fan, not a serious NASCAR fan, but I'm a casual NASCAR fan. And as a NASCAR fan, I enjoy the personalities. That's what I watch sports for, is the personalities of the individuals. And Tony Stewart has a bigger-than-life personality. It's usually raw, but it's aggressive and belligerent. But he's an interesting character. Well, it's apparent to me that Tony Stewart's aggressiveness, belligerence, is why a young man is dead today. When you watch the video, and I would encourage, there's nothing that is gruesome of a video. Yes, a Ward dies, but you don't see him underneath the car. But you do see him coming down the track. The car that misses him. Misses him by a mile. That's an exaggeration, but it's a figure of speech. The car that misses him in front of Tony Stewart's is down within 5 feet of the apron of the track and misses the kid by a lot. Let's say the track is 25, 30 feet wide at that point. And it's pinched in, of course, by the wrecked car at the top and the young man Ward walking down the track. But the first car that passed him right in front of Tony Stewart misses him by a long shot, way down on the apron, about 5 feet from the apron of the track, and misses him by at least 10 feet, maybe 15 feet. Tony Stewart's the next car by. He's not down on the apron of the track. Tony Stewart's car is halfway up the track. So what's he doing there? I mean, why wouldn't you give the most room possible to the wrecked car, which is the reason for the caution? But no, he's halfway up the track. And therefore, if he did nothing, he was going to pass within a foot or two of Ward. But before he reaches Ward, you have to listen to the video. He accelerates. He revs that engine to a roar. And immediately, the sprint car, as they always do when you accelerate, it moved to the outside of the track. There was very little room with Tony Stewart in the middle of the track to start with. And then he accelerates as he approaches the kid, and that car goes not only to the outside of the track, by the time Tony Stewart gets out of it, he's the upper wall. It moves right up the track. It was no chance that kid wasn't going to be hit by Tony Stewart's actions. Now, I think there's a 0% possibility that Tony Stewart intended to kill him. I think there's a slim chance that Tony Stewart wanted to hit him. There is no chance that Tony Stewart envisioned the kid being run over by his tire. But Tony Stewart is an expert at manipulating sprint cars. He knows that every time you accelerate a sprint car, that it moves to the outside of that track. He knew that when he hit the accelerator, his car, which was already in the center of the track, very close to Ward, was going to close that gap Now, whether he did it because he wanted to get away from Ward because he was embarrassed by Ward holding him accountable for wrecking his car, whether he wanted to send Ward a message kind of brushing him back and showing, you know, what, how dare you, you know, openly criticize me, I'm the great Tony Stewart, or whether he wanted to drown out Ward's yelling with the roar of the engine. I don't know which one of those three. But the acceleration was deliberate. So was driving up the middle of the track. And the consequence of Tony Stewart's reckless response is that young man's dead. That's a felony. You don't have to have the intent to harm him or to kill him. But if your behavior is reckless and a person dies, reckless homicide is a felony. And there is no question that Tony Stewart in those circumstances was reckless. Glenn, do you have a comment on that, or we're going to move to the briefing that I received this morning? Or we can talk a little bit about Robin Williams. Maybe we should talk about Robin Williams. Robin Williams died. I happen to have been a Robin Williams fan. I attended Robin Williams performances. My wife and I did. My youngest son and I in particular, but both sons, had recordings of Robin Williams, and we would listen to his recordings because although he had a trash mouth, that man was funny. You know, Good Morning Vietnam is one of the funniest movies, but also a heart-wrenching movie. But it is extraordinarily funny. That Mrs. Doubtfire, what a funny movie. Robin Williams was a real talent. But Robin Williams chose to use cocaine, chose to drink to excess. And when life turned sour on him, when he lost his television show and his last movie was a complete flop, he couldn't deal with life because he had numbed his ability to exercise good judgment through drugs and alcohol. And he killed himself.